if I can get you out of the machine, the shadow of the machine may remain.
I was thinking about that most of last night, Terry said.
I'm still thinking about it, Marcy said.
Howie leaned forward, hands clasped.
It would help if we had some physical evidence to match theirs.
The Channel 81 tape is fine, and when you add in your colleagues, it's probably all we need, but I'm greedy. I want more.
Physical evidence from one of the busiest hotels in Cap City and 4 days later? Marcy asked, unaware that she was echoing Bill Samuels not long before.
That seems unlikely.
Terry was looking off into space, brows drawn together.
Not entirely unlikely.
Terry? Howie asked. What are you thinking about?
He looked around at them, smiling.
There might be something. There just might be.
15. The fire pit was indeed open for brunch, so Ralph went there first. Two of the staff who had been working on the night of the murder were currently on duty, the hostess and a crew-cut waiter who looked about old enough to buy a beer.
The hostess was no help. We were mobbed that night, Detective.
And while the waiter vaguely remembered serving a large group of teachers, he was equivocal when Ralph showed him Terry's picture from the previous year's FCHS yearbook. He said that, yes, he sorta remembered a guy who looked like that, but he couldn't swear it was the guy in the picture. He said he wasn't even sure the guy had been with that bunch of teachers. Hey, man, I might have just served him a hot wing platter at the bar.
So that was that.
Ralph's luck at the Sheraton was at first no better. He was able to confirm that Maitland and William Quaid had stayed in room 644 on Tuesday night, and the hotel manager was able to show him the bill, but it was Quaid's signature. He had used his MasterCard. The manager also told him that room 644 had been occupied every night since Maitland and Quaid checked out and had been cleaned every morning.
"And we offer turn-down service," said the manager, adding insult to injury. "That means on most days the room was cleaned twice."
Yes, Detective Anderson was welcome to review the security footage, and Ralph did it without any complaints about how Alec Pelley had already been allowed to do so. Ralph was not a Cap City police officer, which meant diplomacy was the better part of valor. The footage was in full color and sharp. No elderly Zonies Gomart cameras for the Cap City Sheraton. He saw a man who looked like Terry in the lobby, in the gift shop, doing a quick Wednesday morning workout in the hotel's fitness room, and outside the hotel ballroom, waiting in the autograph line. The stuff from the lobby and gift shop was iffy, but there could be little doubt, at least in his mind, that the guy signing in to use the exercise equipment and the guy waiting in line for an autograph was his son's old coach, the one who taught Derek to bunt, thus changing his nickname from Swiffer to Push It. In his mind, Ralph could hear his wife telling him that forensic evidence from Cap City was the missing piece, the golden ticket. If Terry was here, she'd said, meaning in Flint City committing murder, then the double must have been there. It's the only thing that makes sense.
None of it makes sense, he muttered, looking at the monitor.
On it was a frozen image of a man who certainly looked like Terry Maitland, caught laughing about something as he stood in the autograph line with his department head, Roundhill.
Pardon? Asked the hotel dick who had shown him the footage.
Nothing.
Can I show you anything else?
No, but thanks. This had been a fool's errand. The Channel 81 tape of the lecture had pretty much rendered the security footage moot anyway, because it was Terry during the Q&A. No one could doubt it. Except in one corner of his mind, Ralph still did. The way Terry had stood to ask his question, as if he'd known that a camera would be on him. It was just so goddamn perfect. Was it possible that the whole thing was a setup? An amazing but ultimately explicable act of legerdemain? Ralph didn't see how it could be.
But he didn't know how David Copperfield had walked through the Great Wall of China, and Ralph had seen that on TV. If it was so, Terry Maitland wasn't just a murderer. He was a murderer who was laughing at them.
"Detective, just a heads up," said the hotel dick. "I've got a note from Harley Bright. He's the boss, saying all the stuff you just looked at is supposed to be saved for a lawyer named Howard Gold."
"I don't care what you do with it," Ralph said. "Mail it off to Sarah Palin in Whistle Dick, Alaska, for all I care. I'm going home." "Yes, good idea. Go home, sit in his backyard with Jeannie, split a six with her, four for him, two for her, and try not to go crazy thinking about this goddamn paradox." The dick walked him to the door of the security office.
"News says you got the guy who killed that kid."
"News says a lot of things. Thank you for your time, sir."
"Always a pleasure to help the police."
If only you had, Ralph thought. He halted on the far side of the lobby, hand out to push the revolving door, struck by a thought. There was one other place he should check, as long as he was here. According to Terry, Debbie Grant had booked for the woman's room as soon as Coben's lecture ended, and she had been gone a long time. "I went down to the newsstand with Ev and Billy," Terry had said. "She met us there." The newsstand, it turned out, was a kind of auxiliary gift shop. An overly made-up woman with graying hair was behind the counter rearranging bits of inexpensive jewelry. Ralph showed her his ID and asked her if she had been working the previous Tuesday afternoon.
"Honey," she said, "I work here every day, unless I'm sick. I don't get anything extra from the books and magazines, but when it comes to this jewelry and the souvenir coffee cups, I'm on commission."
"Would you remember this man? He was here last Tuesday with a bunch of English teachers for a lecture." He showed her Terry's picture.
"Sure, I remember him. He asked about the Flint County book. First one to do that in Jesus knows how long. I didn't stock it. The darn thing was here when I started running this place back in 2010. I should take it down, I guess, but replace it with what? Anything way above or way below eye level doesn't move. You find that out quick running a place like this. At least the stuff down low is cheap. That top shelf is your expensive stuff, with photographs and glossy pages."
"What book are we talking about, Ms.?" He looked at her name tag. "Ms. Lavelle?"
"That one," she said, pointing. "A pictorial history of Flint County, Dury County, and Canning Township. Jawbreaker title, huh?"
He turned and saw two racks of reading material next to a shelf of souvenir cups and plates. One rack held magazines, the other held a mixture of paperback and current hardcover fiction. On the top shelf of the latter were half a dozen larger volumes, what Jeannie would have called coffee table books. They were shrink-wrapped so that browsers couldn't smudge the pages or dog-ear the corners. Ralph walked over and looked up at them. Terry, who had a good 3 inches on him, wouldn't have had to look up or stand on tiptoe to take one of them down. He started to reach for the book she'd mentioned and changed his mind. He turned back to Ms. Lavelle. "Tell me what you remember."
"What about that guy?" "Nothing much to tell. The gift shop got way busy after the lecture broke, I remember that. But I only got a trickle of custom. You know why, don't you?"
Ralph shook his head, trying to be patient. There was something here, all right, and he thought, hoped, he knew what it was.
"They didn't want to lose their place in line, of course, and they all had the new book by Mr. Coben to read while they waited. But these three gentlemen did come in, and one of them, the fat one, bought that new Lisa Gardner hardback. The other two just browsed. Then a lady poked her head in and said she was all set, so they left. To get their autographs, I suppose."
"But one of them, the tall one, expressed an interest in the Flint County book."
"Yes, but I think it was the Canning Township part of the title that caught his eye. Did he say his family lived there for a long time?" I don't know, Ralph said. You tell me.
Pretty sure he did. He took it down, but when he saw the price tag, $79.99, he put it back on the shelf.
And whoomp, there it was. Has anyone looked at that book since, taken it down and handled it?
That one? You're kidding.
Ralph went to the rack, stood on his toes, and took down the shrink-wrapped book. He held it by the sides, using his palms. On the front was a sepia-toned photograph of a long-ago funeral procession. Six cowboys, all wearing battered hats and holstered pistols, were carrying a plank coffin into a dusty cemetery. A preacher, also wearing a holstered gun, was waiting for them at the head of an open grave, with a Bible in his hands. Ms. Lavelle brightened considerably.
You actually want to buy that?
Yes.
Well, hand it over so I can scan it.
I don't think so. He held the book up with the barcode sticker to the shrink wrap facing her, and she beeped it.
That's 84.14 with the tax, but we'll call it 84 even.
Ralph set the book carefully on end to hand over his credit card. He tucked his receipt into his breast pocket, then once again picked the book up using just his palms, holding it out like a chalice. He handled it, he said, less to make sure of her than to confirm his own absurd look. You sure the man in the picture I showed you handled this book?
Took it down and said that cover picture was taken in Canning Township. Then he looked at the price and put it back, just like I told you. Is it evidence or something?
I don't know, Ralph said, looking down at the antique mourners gracing the cover. But I'm going to find out.
16. Frank Peterson's body had been released to the Donnelly Brothers funeral home on Thursday afternoon. Arlene Peterson had arranged for this and everything else, including the obituary, the flowers, the Friday morning memorial service, the funeral itself, the graveside service, and the Saturday evening gathering of friends and family. It had to be her. Fred was useless at making any kind of social arrangements at the best of times.
But this time it has to be me, Fred told himself when he and Ollie got home from the hospital. It has to be, because there is no one else. And that guy from Donnelly will help me. They're experts at this. Only how was he supposed to pay for a second funeral, so soon after the first? Would insurance cover it? He didn't know. Arlene had handled all that stuff, too. They had a deal. He made the money, and she paid the bills. He would have to look through her desk for the insurance paperwork. The thought of it made him tired. They sat in the living room. Ollie turned on the television. There was a soccer match on. They watched it a while, although neither of them really cared for the game. They were pro football guys. At last Fred got up, trudged into the hall, and brought back Arlene's old red address book. He turned to the D's, and yes, there was Donnelly Brothers, but her usual neat script was shaky. Then why not? She wouldn't have noted down the number of a funeral parlor before Frank died, now would she? The Petersons were supposed to have years before needing to worry about burial rites. Years. Looking at the address book, its red leather faded and scuffed, Fred thought of all the times he had seen it in her hands, jotting down return addresses from envelopes in the old days, from the internet more recently. He began to cry. I can't, he said. I just can't. Not so soon after Frankie. On TV, the announcer screamed,
Go!
And the players in the red shirts started to jump all over each other. Ollie turned it off and held out his hand. I'll do it. Fred looked at him, eyes red and streaming. Ollie nodded. It's okay, Dad. Really. I'll take care of it. The whole deal. Why don't you go upstairs and lie down?
and although Fred knew it was probably wrong to leave his 17-year-old son with this burden, he did just that. He promised himself he would carry his share of the weight in time, but right now he needed to take a nap. He was really very tired.
17. Alec Pelley wasn't able to break free of his own family commitments that Sunday until 3:30. It was after 5 when he reached the Cap City Sheraton, but the afternoon sun was still burning a hole in the sky. He parked in the hotel turnaround, slipped the parking valet a tin, and told him to keep his car close. In the newsstand, Lorette Lavelle was once more rearranging her bits of jewelry. Alec's visit there was brief. He went back outside, leaned against his Explorer, and called Howie Gold. "I beat Anderson to the security footage, plus the TV tape, but he beat me to the book, and bought it. I guess you'd have to call that a wash." "Fuck," Howie said. "How did he even know about it?" "Well, I don't think he did. I think it was a combination of luck and old-fashioned police work. The woman who works in the newsstand says a guy took it down on the day of Coben's lecture, saw the price tag, almost $80, and put it back. Didn't seem to know the guy was Maitland, so I guess she doesn't watch the news. She told Anderson, and Anderson bought the book. She says he walked out holding it by the sides and with the palms of his hands." "Hoping to raise prints that don't match Terry's," Howie said, thus suggesting that whoever handled that book was not Terry. "Won't work. God knows how many people may have taken that book down and handled it. The woman who runs the newsstand would beg to disagree. She says that one just sat up there, month in and month out." "Makes no difference." Howie didn't sound worried, which left Alec free to worry for both of them. It wasn't much, but it was something. A small flaw in a case that had been shaping up as pretty as a painting in a museum. A possible flaw, he reminded himself, and Howie could easily work around it. Juries didn't care much about what wasn't there. "Just wanted you to know, boss. It's what you pay me for." "Okay, now I know it. You'll be there for the arraignment tomorrow, right?"
"Wouldn't miss it," Alec said. "Did you talk to Samuels about bail?"
"I did. The conversation was brief. He said he would fight it with every fiber of his being, his very words."
"Jesus, does a guy have an off button?"
"A good question.
Will you get it anyway?"
"I have a good chance. Nothing's a sure thing, but I'm almost positive."
"If you do, tell Maitland not to take any neighborhood strolls. Lots of people keep a home protection weapon handy, and right now he's the least popular guy in Flint City."
"He'll be restricted to his home, and you can be sure the cops will be keeping the house under surveillance."
Howie sighed. A shame about that book.
Alec ended the call and jumped back in his car. He wanted to be home in plenty of time to make popcorn before Game of Thrones.
18. Ralph Anderson and State Police Detective Unell Sablo met with the Flint County DA that evening in the den of Bill Samuels' home on the city's north side, an almost posh neighborhood of large houses that aspired to McMansion status and didn't quite make it. Outside, Samuels' two girls were chasing each other through the backyard sprinkler as dusk slowly dissolved into dark. Samuels' ex-wife had stayed around to cook dinner for them. Samuels had been in fine fettle all through the meal, often patting his ex's hand and even holding it for brief periods, to which she did not seem to object. Pretty chummy for a couple living in Splitsville, Ralph thought, and good for them. But now dinner was finished. The ex was packing up the girls' things, and Ralph had an idea that D.A. Samuels' good mood would soon be finished, too. A pictorial history of Flint County, Dury County, and Canning Township sat on the den's coffee table. It was in a clear plastic baggie, taken from one of Ralph's kitchen drawers and slipped carefully over the book. The funeral cortege now looked blurry because the shrink wrap had been dusted with fingerprint powder. A single print,
A thumb stood out on the book's front cover near the spine. It was as clear as the date on a new penny.
"There are four more good ones on the back," Ralph said. "It's how you pick up a heavy book. Thumb in front, fingers on the back, slightly splayed to support. I would have printed it right there in Cap City, but I didn't have Terry's prints for comparison purposes. So I grabbed what I needed at the station and did it at home."
Samuels elevated his brows. "You took his print card out of evidence?"
"Nah, photocopied it."
"Don't keep us in suspense," Sablo said.
"I won't," Ralph said. "They match. The prints on this book belong to Terry Maitland."
The Mr. Sunshine, who'd sat beside his ex at the dinner table, disappeared. Mr. Gonna Rain a Bitch took his place.
"You can't be sure of that without a computer match."
"Bill, I was doing this before there was such a thing. Back in the days when you were still trying to look up girls' skirts in high school study hall.
They're Maitland's prints, and computer comparison will confirm it. Look at these."
He took a small bundle of cards from the inner pocket of his sport coat and laid them out in two rows on the coffee table.
"Here are Terry's prints from his booking last night, and here are Terry's prints from the shrink wrap. Now you tell me."
Samuels and Sablo leaned forward, looking from the row of cards on the left to the ones on the right. Sablo sat back first.
"I buy it."
"I won't without a computer comparison,"
Samuel said. The words came out sounding stilted because his jaw was jutting. Under other circumstances, that might have been funny. Ralph made no immediate reply. He was curious about Bill Samuels and hopeful, he was hopeful by nature, that his earlier judgment about the man, that he might cut and run if faced with a really spirited counterattack, had been wrong. Samuel's ex-wife still held him in some regard. That had been obvious, and the little girls loved him big time. But such evidence only spoke to one facet of a man's character. A guy at home wasn't necessarily the same guy at work, especially when the fellow in question was ambitious and faced with a sudden obstacle that might nip all his big plans in the bud. These things mattered to Ralph. They mattered a great deal because he and Samuels were bound together by this case, win or lose.
"It's impossible," Samuels said, one hand going to brush down the cowlick, but tonight the cowlick wasn't there. Tonight it was behaving. "He can't have been in two places at the same time."
"Yet so it appears," Sablo said. "Until today, there was no forensic evidence in Cap City. Now there is."
Samuels brightened momentarily.
"Maybe he handled the book at some prior date, preparing his alibi. All part of the setup."
Apparently forgetting his previous assessment that the murder of Frank Peterson had been the impulse act of a man who could no longer control his urges.
"The idea can't be discounted," Ralph said, "but I've seen a lot of prints, and these look fairly fresh. The quality of the friction ridge detail is very good. That wouldn't be the case if these had been made weeks or months ago."
Speaking almost too softly to hear, Sablo said,
"Mano, it's like you took a hit on 12 and got a face card."
"What?"
Samuel snapped his head around.
"Blackjack," Ralph said. "He's saying it would have been better if we hadn't found it, if we'd just stood pat."
They considered this. When Samuel spoke, he sounded almost pleasant. A man just passing the time.
"Here's a hypothetical for you. What if you had dusted down that shrink wrap and found nothing, or just a few unidentifiable blurs?"
"We wouldn't be better off," Sablo said, "but we wouldn't be worse off."
Samuels nodded.
"In that case, hypothetically speaking, Ralph would just be a guy who'd bought a fairly expensive book.
He wouldn't throw it away. He'd call it a good idea that didn't pan out and put it on his shelf. After stripping off the shrink wrap and throwing it away, of course."
Sablo looked from Samuels to Ralph, his face giving nothing away.
"And these fingerprint cards?" Ralph asked. "What about them?"
"What cards?"
Samuels asked.
"I don't see any cards. Do you, Yoon?"
"I don't know if I do or not," Sablo said.
You're talking about destroying evidence, Ralph said.
Not at all. This is all just hypothetical. Samuels again raised his hand to brush at the cowlick that wasn't there.
But here's something to think about, Ralph. You went to the station first, but did the comparison at your home. Was your wife there?
Jeannie was at her book club.
Uh-huh. And look, the book's in a glad bag instead of an official one. Not entered into evidence.
Not yet, Ralph said, but instead of thinking about the different facets of Bill Samuels' character, he was now forced to think about the different facets of his own.
I'm just saying that the same hypothetical possibility might have been in the back of your own mind.
Had it been? Ralph could not honestly say. And if it had been, why had it been? To save an ugly black mark on his career now that this thing was not just going sideways but in danger of tipping over? No, he said. This will be logged into evidence and will become part of discovery. Because that kid is dead, Bill. What happens to us is small shit compared to that.
I agree, Sablo said.
Of course you do, Samuel said. He sounded tired. Lieutenant Yun Sablo will survive either way. Speaking of survival, Ralph said, what about Terry Maitland's? What if we really do have the wrong man?
We don't, Samuel said. The evidence says we don't.
And on that note, the meeting ended. Ralph went back to the station. There he logged in a pictorial history of Flint County, Dury County, and Canning Township and stored it in the accumulating file. He was glad to be rid of it. As he went around the building to retrieve his personal car, his cell rang. It was his wife's picture on the screen, and when he answered, he was alarmed by the sound of her voice. Honey, have you been crying?
Derek called from camp.
Ralph's heart kicked up a notch. Is he all right?
He's fine. Physically fine. But some of his friends emailed him about Terry and he's upset. He said it must be wrong, that Coach T would never do a thing like that.
Oh, is that all? He started moving again, feeling for his keys with his free hand.
No, it's not all, she said fiercely. Where are you?
At the station, then headed home.
Can you go to county first? And talk to him.
To Terry? I guess I could if you'll agree to see me, but why?
Set aside all the evidence for a minute. All of it, on both sides, and answer me one question, truly and from your heart. Will you do that?
Okay. He could hear the faraway drone of semis on the interstate. Closer, the peaceful summer sound of crickets in the grass growing alongside the brick building where he had worked for so many years. He knew what she was going to ask.
Do you think Terry Maitland killed that little boy?
Ralph thought of how the man who'd taken Willow Rainwater's cab to Dubrow had called her ma'am instead of by her name, which he should have known. He thought about how the man who'd parked the white van behind Shorty's pub had asked directions to the nearest dock in the box, although Terry Maitland had lived in Flint City all his life. He thought about the teachers who would swear Terry had been with them, both at the time of the abduction and at the time of the murder. Then he thought about how convenient it was that Terry had not just asked a question at Mr. Harlan Coben's talk, but had risen to his feet, as if to make sure he would be seen and recorded. Even the fingerprints on the book. How perfect was that?
Ralph, are you still there?
I don't know, he said. Maybe if I'd coached with him like Howie, but I only watched him coach Derek. So the answer to your question, truly and from my heart, is I just don't know.
Then go there. She said, look him in the eyes and ask him.
Samuels is apt to rip me a new one if he finds out, Ralph said.
I don't care about Bill Samuels, but I care about our son. And I know you do too. Do it for him, Ralph. For Derek.
19. It turned out that Arlene Peterson did have burial insurance, so that was all right. Holly found the pertinent papers in the bottom drawer of her little desk, in a folder between mortgage agreement, said mortgage now almost paid off, and appliance warranties. He called the funeral parlor, where a man with the soft voice of a professional mourner, maybe a Donnelly brother, maybe not, thanked him and told him that your mother has arrived. As if she'd gotten there on her own, maybe in an Uber. The professional mourner asked if Ollie needed an obituary form for the newspaper. Ollie said no. He was looking at two blank forms right there on the desk. His mother, careful even in her grief, must have made photocopies of the one she'd gotten for Frank in case she made a mistake. So that was all right, too. Would he want to come in tomorrow and make arrangements for the funeral and the burial? Ollie said he didn't think so. He thought his father should be the one to do that. Once the question of paying for his mother's final rites was put to rest, Ollie dropped his head onto her desk and cried for a while. He did it quietly, so as not to wake his father. When the tears dried up, he filled out one of the obituary forms, printing everything because his handwriting sucked. Once that chore was finished, he went out to the kitchen and surveyed the mess there. Pasta on the linoleum, chicken carcass lying under the clock, all those Tupperwares and covered dishes on the counters. It reminded him of something his mom used to say after big family meals. The pigs ate here. He got a hefty bag from under the sink and dumped everything in, starting with the chicken carcass, which looked especially gruesome. Then he washed the floor. Once everything was spick, something else his mother used to say, he discovered he was hungry. That seemed wrong, but was still a fact. People were basically animals, he realized. Even with your mother and little brother dead, you had to eat and shit out what you ate. The body demanded it. He opened the fridge and discovered it was packed top to bottom and side to side with more casseroles, more Tupperware containers, more cold cuts. He selected a shepherd's pie, its surface a snowy plain of mashed potato, and stuck it in the oven at 350. While he was leaning against the counter and waiting for it to heat, feeling like a visitor inside his own head, his dad wandered in. Fred's hair was a mess. You're all sticky uppy, Arlene Peterson would have said. He needed a shave. His eyes were puffy and dazed. I took one of your mother's pills and slept too long, he said. Don't worry about it, Dad. You cleaned up the kitchen. I should have helped you. It's okay. Your mother. The funeral. Fred didn't seem to know how to go on, and Ollie noticed that his fly was unzipped. This filled him with an inchoate pity. Yet he didn't feel like crying again. He seemed to be cried out, at least for the time being. Something else that was all right. Must count my blessings, Ollie thought. We're in good shape, he told his dad. She had burial insurance, you both do, and she's there, at the place, you know, the parlor. He was afraid to say funeral, because that might get his father going, which might get him going again.
Oh, good.
Fred sat down and put the heel of his hand against his forehead.
I should have done that. It was my job. My responsibility. I never meant to sleep so long.
You can go down tomorrow, pick out the coffin and all.
Where?
Donnelly Brothers, same as Frank.
She's dead, Fred marveled. I don't even know how to think of it.
Yeah, Ollie said, although he had been able to think of nothing else. How she'd kept trying to apologize, right to the end. As if it was all her fault, when none of it was. The funeral guy says there's stuff you'll have to decide about. Will you be able to do that?
Sure. I'll be better tomorrow. Something smells good.
Shepherd's pie.
Did your mother make it? Or did someone bring it?
I don't know.
Well, it smells good.
They ate at the kitchen table. Ollie put their dishes in the sink because the dishwasher was full. They went into the living room. Now it was baseball on ESPN, Phillies against the Mets. They watched without talking, each in his own way exploring the edges of the hole that had appeared in their lives, so as not to fall in. After a while, Ollie went out on the back steps and sat looking up at the stars. There were plenty of them. He also saw a meteor, an Earth satellite, and several planes. He thought about how his mother was dead and would see none of these things again. It was totally absurd that such a thing should be so. When he went back in, the baseball game was going into the ninth, all tied up, and his father had gone to sleep in his chair. Ollie kissed him on the top of his head. Fred didn't stir.
20. Ralph got a text on his way to the county jail. It was from Kinderman in State Police Computer Forensics. Ralph pulled over at once and called back. Kinderman answered on the first ring.
"Don't you guys take Sunday night off?" Ralph asked.
"What can I say? We're geeks." In the background, Ralph could hear the bellow of a heavy metal band. "Besides, I always think the good news can wait, but bad news should be passed on right away. We're not done exploring Maitland's hard drives for hidden files, and some of these kiddie fiddlers can be pretty clever about that, but on the surface he's clean. No kiddie porn, no porn of any kind. Not on his desktop, not on his laptop, not on his iPad, not on his phone. He looks like Mr. White Hat."
"What about his history?"
"There's plenty, but all stuff you'd expect. Shopping sites like Amazon, news blogs like Huffington Post, half a dozen sports sites. He keeps track of the major league standings, and he appears to be a fan of the Tampa Bay Rays. That alone suggests there's something wrong with his head. He watches Ozark on Netflix and The Americans on iTunes. I enjoy that one myself."
"Keep digging."
"It's what they pay me for."
Ralph parked in an official vehicles-only slot behind the county jail, took his on-duty card from the glove compartment, and put it on the dashboard. A corrections officer, L. Keene, according to his name tag, was waiting for him and escorted him to one of the interview rooms.
"This is irregular, Detective. It's almost 10 o'clock.
"I'm aware of the time, and I'm not here for recreational purposes."
"Does the DA know you're here?"
"Above your pay grade, Officer Keene." Ralph sat down on one side of the table and waited to see if Terry would agree to make an appearance. No porn on Terry's computers, and no stashes of porn in the house, at least that they had found so far. But as Kinderman had pointed out, pedos could be clever. How clever was it for him to show his face, though, and leave fingerprints? He knew what Samuels would say. Terry was in a frenzy. Once, it seemed like a long time ago, this had made sense to Ralph. Keene led Terry in. He was wearing county browns and cheap plastic flip-flops. His hands were cuffed in front of him.
"Take off the bracelets, officer."
Keene shook his head.
"Protocol."
"I'll take responsibility." Keene smiled without humor.
"No, detective, you will not. This is my house, and if he decides to leap across the table and choke you, it's on me. But tell you what, I won't tether him to the cuff bolt. How's that?"
Terry smiled at this, as if to say, "You see what I have to deal with?" Ralph sighed.
"You can leave us, Officer Keene, and thanks."
Keene left, but he would be watching through the one-way glass, probably listening as well. This was going to get back to Samuels. There was simply no way around it. Ralph looked at Terry.
"Don't just stand there. Sit down, for God's sake."
Terry sat and folded his hands on the table. The handcuff chain rattled.
"Howie Gold wouldn't approve of me meeting you."
He continued to smile as he said it.
"Samuels wouldn't either, so we're even."
"What do you want?"
"Answers. If you're innocent, why do I have half a dozen witnesses who've identified you? Why are your fingerprints on the branch used to sodomize that boy?
and all over the van that was used to abduct him. Terry shook his head. The smile was gone.
I'm as mystified as you are. I just thank God, his only begotten son, and all the saints that I can prove I was in Cap City. What if I couldn't, Ralph? I think we both know. I'd be in the death house up in McAllister before the end of summer, and 2 years from now I'd be riding the needle. Maybe sooner, because the courts are rigged to the right all the way to the top, and your pal Samuels would plow over my appeals like a bulldozer over a kid's sandcastle. The first thing that rose to Ralph's lips was, he's not my pal. What he said was, the van interests me, the one with the New York plates. Can't help you there. The last time I was in New York was on my honeymoon, and that was 16 years ago. It was Ralph's turn to smile. I didn't know that, but I knew you hadn't been there recently. We back-checked your movements over the last 6 months. Nothing but a trip to Ohio in April. Yes, to Dayton, the girls' spring vacation. I wanted to see my dad, and they wanted to go. Marcy did, too. Your father lives in Dayton? If you can call what he's doing these days living. It's a long story and nothing to do with this. No sinister white vans involved, not even the family car. We flew southwest. I don't care how many of my fingerprints you found in the van that guy used to abduct Frank Peterson. I didn't steal it. I've never even seen it. I don't expect you to believe it, but it's the truth. Nobody thinks you stole the van in New York, Ralph said. Bill Samuels' theory is that whoever did steal it dumped it somewhere in this vicinity with the ignition key still in it. You re-stole it and cashed it somewhere until you were ready to do what you did. Pretty careful for a man who went about his business with his bare face hanging out. Samuels will tell the jury you were in a kill frenzy, and they'll believe it. Will they still believe it after Ev, Billy, and Debbie testify? And after Howie shows the jury that tape of Coben's lecture? Ralph didn't want to go there, at least not yet. Did you know Frank Peterson? Terry uttered a bark of laughter. That's one of those questions Howie wouldn't want me to answer. Does that mean you won't? As a matter of fact, I will. I knew him to say hi to. I know most of the kids on the west side, but I didn't know him, if you see what I mean. He was still in grade school and didn't play sports. Couldn't miss that red hair, though, like a stop sign, him and his brother both. I had Ollie in Little League, but he didn't move up to City League when he turned 13. He wasn't bad in the outfield, and he could hit a little, but he lost interest. Some of them do. So you didn't have your eye on Frankie. No, Ralph, I have no sexual interest in children. Didn't just happen to see him walking his bike across the parking lot of Gerald's Fine Groceries and say, aha, here's my chance. Terry looked at him with a silent contempt that Ralph found hard to bear, but he didn't drop his eyes. After a moment, Terry sighed, raised his cuffed hands to the mirror side of the one-way glass and called, we're done here. Not quite, Ralph said. I need you to answer one more question, and I want you to look me right in the eyes when you do it. Did you kill Frank Peterson? Terry's gaze didn't waver. I did not. Officer Keene took Terry away. Ralph sat where he was, waiting for Keene to come back and escort him through the three locked doors between this interview room and free air. So now he had the answer to the question Jeannie had told him to ask, and the answer, given with unwavering eye contact, was, I did not. Ralph wanted to believe him, and could not. The Arraignment, July 16th. 1.
No, Howie Gold said. No, no, no.
It's for his own protection, Ralph said. Surely you see.
What I see is a front page photograph in the paper. What I see is lead story footage on every channel showing my client walking into district court wearing a bulletproof vest over his suit.
looking already convicted, in other words. The cuffs are bad enough. There were 7 men in the county jail's visitor's room, where the toys had been neatened away in their colorful plastic boxes and the chairs had been upturned on the tables. Terry Maitland stood with Howie at his side. Facing them were County Sheriff Dick Doolin, Ralph Anderson, and Vernon Gilstrap, the assistant district attorney. Samuels would already be at the county courthouse awaiting their arrival. Sheriff Doolin continued to hold out the bulletproof vest, saying nothing. On it, in bright accusatory yellow, were the letters FCDC, standing for Flint County Department of Corrections. Its 3 Velcro straps, one for each arm, one to cinch the waist, hung down. 2 jail officers, call them guards and they would correct you, stood by the door to the lobby, meaty arms folded. One had supervised Terry as he shaved with a disposable razor. The other had gone through the pockets of the suit and shirt Marcy had brought, not neglecting to check the seam down the back of the blue tie. ADA Gilstrap looked at Terry. "What do you say, chum? Want to risk getting shot? Okay by me if you do. Save the state the expense of a bunch of appeals before you take the needle." "That's uncalled for," Howie said. Gilstrap, a long-timer who would almost certainly choose to retire and with a fat pension if Bill Samuels lost the upcoming election, only smirked. "Hey, Mitchell," Terry said. The guard who had monitored Terry's shave, making sure the prisoner did not try to cut his throat with a single-blade bick, raised his eyebrows but didn't unfold his arms. "How hot is it outside?"
84 when I came in," Mitchell said. "Going up close on 100 come noon, they said on the radio."
"No vest," Terry said to the sheriff, and broke into a smile that made him look very young. "I don't want to stand in front of Judge Carter in a sweaty shirt. I coached his grandson in Little League." Gilstrap, looking alarmed at this, took a notebook from inside his plaid jacket and jotted something.
"Let's get going," Howie said. He took Terry by the arm.
Ralph's cell phone rang. He took it from the left side of his belt, his holstered service weapon was on the right, and looked at the screen.
"Hold it, hold it. I have to take this."
"Oh, come on," Howie said. "What is this, an arraignment or a dog and pony show?" Ralph ignored him and walked to the far side of the room where there were coin-op snack and soda vending machines. He stood beneath a sign reading, "For visitor use only," spoke briefly, listened. He ended the call and returned to the others.
"Okay, let's do it."
Officer Mitchell had stepped between Howie and Terry long enough to snap cuffs on Terry's wrists.
"Too tight?" he asked.
Terry shook his head.
"Then let's walk."
Howie took off his suit coat and draped it over the cuffs. The 2 officers led Terry out of the room with Gilstrap in the lead, strutting like a majorette. Howie fell in step next to Ralph. He spoke in a low voice. "This is a clusterfuck." And when Ralph made no reply, "Okay, fine. Clam up all you want to. But between now and the grand jury, we have to sit down. You, me, and Samuels. Pelly, too, if you want. The facts of the case aren't going to come out today, but they will come out. And then you won't have to worry about just state or regional news coverage. CNN, Fox, MSNBC, the internet blogs, they'll all be here, savoring the weirdness. It'll be O.J. meets the Exorcist." Yes, and Ralph had an idea how he would do all he could to make that happen. If he could get reporters to focus on the question of a man who appeared to have been in 2 places at the same time, he wouldn't have to worry about them focusing on the boy who had been raped and murdered, perhaps partially eaten.
"I know what you're thinking, but I'm not the enemy here, Ralph. Unless you don't give a shit about anything except seeing Terry convicted, that is, and I don't believe it. That's Samuels, not you. Don't you want to know what happened?"
Ralph made no reply. Marcy Maitland was waiting in the lobby, looking very small between the hugely pregnant Betsy Riggins and Yoon Sablo from the state police. When she saw her husband and started forward, Riggins attempted to hold her back, but Marcy shook her off easily. Sablo only stood pat, watching. Marcy had just time enough to look into her husband's face and kiss his cheek before Officer Mitchell took her by the shoulders and pushed her gently but firmly back toward the sheriff,
who was still holding the bulletproof vest, as if he didn't know what to do with it now that it had been refused.
"Come on now, Mrs. Maitland," Mitchell said. "That's not allowed."
"I love you, Terry," Marcy called as the officers moved him toward the door. "And the girls send theirs." "Same goes back to all of you doubled," Terry said. "Tell them it's going to be all right." Then he was outside, into the hot morning sunshine, and the incoming fire of 2 dozen questions all hurled at once. To Ralph, still in the lobby, those mingled voices sounded more like invective than interrogation. Ralph had to give Howie points for persistence. He still hadn't given up.
"You're one of the good ones. Never took a bribe. Never pitted evidence. Always walked a straight path."
"I think I came close to pitting some evidence last night," Ralph thought. "I think it was close. If Sablo hadn't been there, if it had just been me and Samuels."
Howie's expression was almost pleading. "You've never had a case like this. None of us have. And it's not just a little boy anymore. His mother is dead, too."
Ralph, who hadn't turned on the television that morning, stopped and stared at Howie.
"You say what?" Howie nodded. "Yesterday. Heart attack. That makes her victim number 2. So come on. Don't you want to know? Don't you want to get this right?"
Ralph couldn't hold back any longer. "I do know. And because I do, I'm going to give you one for free, Howie. That call I just took was from Dr. Bogan in the Pathology and Serology Department at General. He doesn't have all of the DNA back yet and won't for at least another couple of weeks, but they crashed the semen sample they took from the backs of the boys' legs. It matches the cheek swabs we took Saturday night. Your client killed Frank Peterson and buggered him and tore away pieces of his flesh. And all that got him so excited that he spunked on the corpse." He strode away quickly, leaving Howie Gold temporarily unable to move or speak, which was good, because the central paradox still remained. DNA didn't lie. But Terry's colleagues weren't lying either. Ralph was sure of it. Add to that the fingerprints on the book from the newsstand and the Channel 81 video. Ralph Anderson was a man of 2 minds, and the double vision was driving him crazy.
2. Until 2015, the Flint County Courthouse had stood next to the Flint County Jail, which was convenient. Prisoners up for arraignment were simply led from one gothic heap of stones to the other, like overgrown children going on a field trip, except, of course, kids going on field trips were rarely handcuffed. Now, a half-constructed civic center stood next door, and prisoners had to be transported 6 blocks to the new courthouse, a 9-story glass box that Wags had dubbed the Chicken Coop. At the curb in front of the jail, waiting to make the trip, 2 police cars with flashing lights, a short blue bus, and Howie's gleaming black SUV. Standing on the sidewalk next to the ladder and looking like a chauffeur in his dark suit and darker shades was Alec Pelley. On the other side of the street, behind police department sawhorses, were the reporters, the camera persons, and a small crowd of looky-loos. Several of the latter were carrying signs. One read, "Execute the Child Killer." Another read, "Maitland, you will burn in hell." Marcy stopped on the top step and stared at these signs with dismay. The county jail corrections officers halted at the foot of the steps, their job done. Sheriff Doolin and ADA Gilstrap, the men technically in charge of this morning's legal ritual, escorted Terry to the lead police car. Ralph and Unell Sablo headed for the one behind. Howie took Marcy's hand and led her to his Escalade.
"Don't look up. Don't give the photographers anything but the top of your head."
"Those signs. Howie, those signs."
"Never mind them. Just keep moving."
Because of the heat, the windows of the blue bus were open. The prisoners inside, most of them weekend warriors bound for their own arraignments on an array of lesser charges, caught sight of Terry. They pressed their faces against the wire mesh, catcalling.
"Hey, faggot! Did you bend your dick getting it in? You're bound for the needle, Maitland.
Did you suck his cock before you bit it off?
Alec started around the Escalade to open the passenger door, but Howie shook his head, motioned him back, and pointed to the rear door on the curbside instead. He wanted to keep Marcy as far as possible from the crowd across the street. Her head was lowered, and her hair obscured her face, but as Howie led her to the door Alec was holding open, he could hear her sobbing, even in the general tumult.
"Mrs. Maitland!"
That was a leather-lunged reporter calling from beyond the sawhorse barricade.
"Did he tell you he was going to do it? Did you try to stop him?"
"Don't look up, don't respond," Howie said. He wished he could tell her not to listen. "This is all under control. Just get in and off we go." As he handed her in, Alec murmured in his ear, "Beautiful, isn't it? Half the city police are on vacation, and FC's fearless sheriff can barely manage crowd control at the Elks barbecue." "Just get us there," Howie said. "I'll ride in back with Marcy." Once Alec was behind the wheel and all the doors were closed, the yells from the crowd and the bus were muted. Ahead of the Escalade, the police cars and the blue bus were pulling out, moving as slowly as a funeral cortege. Alec fell into line. Howie could see the reporter sprinting up the sidewalk, oblivious of the heat, just wanting to be at the chicken coop when Terry arrived. The TV trucks would already be there, parked nose to tail like a herd of grazing mastodons. "They hate him," Marcy said. The little eye makeup she had put on, mostly to hide the bags beneath them, had run, giving her a raccoon-like aspect. "He never did anything but good for this town, and they all hate him."
"That will change when the grand jury refuses to indict," Howie said. "And they will. I know it, and Samuels knows it too."
"Are you sure?"
"I am. In some cases, Marcy, you have to struggle to find even one reasonable doubt. This case is made of them. No way can the grand jury indict."
"That isn't what I meant. Are you sure that people will change their minds?"
"Of course they will."
In the rearview mirror, he saw Alec grimace at that. But sometimes a lie was necessary, and this was one of those times. Until the real killer of Frank Peterson was found, if he ever was, the people of Flint City were going to believe that Terry Maitland had gamed the system and gotten away with murder. They would treat him accordingly. But for now, all Howie could do was focus on the arraignment. 3. As long as Ralph was dealing with prosaic day-to-day affairs, things like what was for supper, a grocery run with Jeannie, an evening call from Derek at camp — these were less frequent now that the kiddo's homesickness was abating — he was more or less okay. But when his attention centered on Terry, as it had to now, a kind of uber-consciousness set in, as if his mind was trying to reassure itself that everything was just as it always had been. Up was up, down was down, and it was just the summer heat in this badly air-conditioned car that was producing fine droplets of sweat under his nose. Each day was to be relished, because life was short, he understood that. But too much was just too much. When the mind's filter disappeared, the big picture disappeared with it. There was no forest, only trees. At its worst, there were no trees either, just bark. When the little procession reached the Flint County Courthouse, Ralph snuggled in behind the sheriff, noting every hot point of sun on the rear bumper of Doolin's cruiser, 4 points in all. The reporters who had been at the county jail were already arriving, streaming into a crowd twice the size of the one that had been waiting at the county jail. They were crammed shoulder to shoulder on the lawn flanking the steps. He could see various station logos on the TV reporters' polo shirts and the dark circles of sweat under their arms. The pretty blonde anchor from Channel 7 out of Cap City arrived with her hair in a tangle and sweat cutting trenches in her showgirl makeup. Sawhorses had been set up here too, but the ebb and flow of the jostling crowd had already knocked some of them askew. A dozen cops, half city police and half sheriff's department, tried their best to keep the steps and the sidewalk clear. 12 weren't enough in Ralph's estimation, not nearly, but summer always depleted the ranks. The reporters jostled for the prime spots on the lawn, unapologetically elbowing the spectators back.
The blonde anchor from Channel 7 tried to make a place for herself in front, flashing her locally famous smile, and was thwacked by a hastily made sign for her pains. The sign featured a crudely drawn hypodermic needle below the message, "Maitland, take your medicine." Her cameraman shoved the guy with the sign backwards, shouldering an elderly woman off her feet in the process. Another woman caught her and fetched the cameraman a good one upside the head with her purse. The purse, Ralph noticed, he was currently helpless not to, was faux alligator and red.
"How did the vultures get here so quick?" Sablo marveled. "Man, they scurry faster than cockroaches when someone turns on the light."
Ralph only shook his head, looking at the crowd with mounting dismay, trying to see it as a whole and unable to in his current state of hypervigilance. As Sheriff Doolin exited his car, brown uniform shirt untucked on one side above his Sam Brown belt, roll of pink fat peeking through the gap, and opened the rear door so that Terry could get out, someone began shouting, "Needle! Needle!" The crowd picked it up, chanting like fans at a football game.
"Needle! Needle! Needle!"
Terry stared at them, one lock of his neatly combed hair coming loose and hanging down above his left eyebrow. Ralph felt he could count every strand. There was a look of pained bewilderment on his face. "Seeing people he knows," Ralph thought. "People whose kids he taught. People whose kids he coached. People he had to his house for end-of-season barbecues. All of them rooting for him to die." One of the sawhorse barricades clattered into the street, the crossbar sliding away. People surged onto the sidewalk. A few of them reporters with mics and notebooks, the rest local citizens who looked ready to string Terry Maitland up from the nearest lamppost. Two of the cops on crowd control rushed over and pushed them back none too gently. Another replaced the barricade, which left the crowd free to break through at another location. Ralph saw what looked like 24 cell phones taking photos and video. "Come on," he said to Sablo. "Let's get him the fuck inside before they clog the steps." They exited the car and hurried toward the courthouse steps, Sablo motioning Doolin and Gilstrap forward. Now Ralph could see Bill Samuels standing inside one of the courthouse doors looking dumbfounded. But why? How could he have not expected this? How could Sheriff Doolin not have expected it? Nor was he himself blameless. Why hadn't he insisted they bring Terry around to the rear doors where most of the courthouse staff entered?
"Get back, folks,"
Ralph shouted.
"This is the process. Let the process work."
Gilstrap and the sheriff started Terry toward the steps, one holding each arm. Ralph had time to register, again, Gilstrap's horrible plaid coat, and to wonder if the man's wife had picked it out. If so, she must secretly hate him. Now, the prisoners in the short bus, who would wait there in the day's strengthening heat, stewing in their own sweat until the star prisoner's arraignment was disposed of, added their voices to the auditory melee, some chanting, "Needle! Needle!" Others just yipping like dogs or howling like coyotes, pistoning their fists against the mesh covering the open windows. Ralph turned to the escalade and raised his open palm to it in a stop gesture, warning Howie and Alec Pelly to keep Marcy where she was until Terry was inside and the crowd settled down. It did no good. The street-side back door opened and then she was out. Dipping one shoulder and eluding Howie Gold's grasping hand as easily as she had slipped away from Betsy Riggins in the county jail's lobby. As she ran to catch up with her husband, Ralph noted her low heels and a shaving cut on one calf. Her hand must have trembled, he thought. When she called Terry's name, the cameras swung toward her. There were five in all, their lenses like glazed eyes. Someone threw a book at her. Ralph couldn't read the title, but he knew that green jacket, "Go Set a Watchman," by Harper Lee. His wife had read it for her book club. The cover came loose, and one of the flaps fluttered. The book hit her shoulder and bounced off. She didn't seem to notice.
"Marcy!"
Ralph shouted, leaving his place by the steps.
"Marcy! Over here!"
She looked around, perhaps searching for him, perhaps not.
She looked like a woman in a dream. Terry stopped, turning at the sound of his wife's name, and resisted when Sheriff Doolin tried to continue pulling him toward the steps. Howie reached Marcy before Ralph could. As he took her arm, a burly man in mechanic's coveralls overturned one of the sawhorses and rushed her.
"Did you cover up for him, you evil cunt? Did you?"
Howie was 60, but still in good shape, and he wasn't shy. As Ralph watched, he flexed his knees and drove a shoulder into the right side of the burly man's midsection, knocking him aside.
"Let me help," Ralph said. "I can take care of her," Howie said. His face was flushed all the way to his thinning hair. He had an arm around Marcy's waist.
"We don't want your help. Just get him inside. Now."
"Jesus, man, what were you thinking? This is a circus."
Ralph thought to say, "It's the sheriff's circus, not mine." Only it was, at least partly, his. And what about Samuels? Had he perhaps foreseen this, even hoped for it, because of the wide news coverage it would surely garner? He turned in time to see a man in a cowboy shirt duck around one of the crowd-controlled cops, sprint across the sidewalk, and hock a mouthful of spit in Terry's face. Before the guy could rush away, Ralph stuck out a foot and sent him sprawling in the street. Ralph could read the tag on his jeans, Levi's Boot Cut. He could see the faded circle of a skull can on the right back pocket. He pointed at one of the crowd-controlled cops. "Cuff that man and stick him in your cruiser."
"Our cars are all around back," the cop said.
He was a county guy and looked not much older than Ralph's son.
"Then stick him on the short bus."
"And leave these people to..."
Ralph lost the rest because he was seeing something amazing. While Doolin and Gilstrap stared at the spectators, Terry was helping the man in the cowboy shirt to his feet. He said something to Cowboy Shirt that Ralph missed, even with his ears seemingly attuned to the whole universe. Cowboy Shirt nodded and started away, hunching one shoulder to blot a scrape on his cheek. Later, Ralph would remember this little moment in the larger play. He would consider it deeply on long nights when sleep wouldn't come. Terry helping the guy get up with his cuffed hands, even as the spit ran down his cheek, like something out of the fucking Bible. The spectators had become a crowd, and now the crowd teetered on the edge of mobism. Some of them had made it onto the 20 or so granite steps leading up to the courthouse doors, in spite of the cops' efforts to push them back. A couple of bailiffs, one male and portly, the other female and scrawny, came out and attempted to help clear them away. Some people went, but others surged into their places. Now, God save the Queen, Gilstrap and Doolin were arguing. Gilstrap wanted Terry back in the car until authority could be reasserted. Doolin wanted him inside immediately, and Ralph knew the sheriff was right. "Come on," he said to them. "Yoon and I will take point."
"Draw your guns," Gilstrap panted.
"That will make them clear the way."
This, of course, was not only against protocol, but insane, and both Doolin and Ralph knew it. The sheriff and the ADA began to move forward again, once more holding Terry's arms. At least the sidewalk was clear at the base of the steps. Ralph could see flecks of mica gleaming in the cement. "Those will leave after images once we're inside," he thought. "They'll hang there in front of my eyes like a little constellation." The blue bus began rocking on its springs as the gleeful inmates threw themselves from one side to the other, still chanting, "Needle! Needle!" along with the crowd outside. A car alarm began to blurt as two young men danced atop someone's previously pristine Camaro, one on the hood and the other on the roof. Ralph saw the cameras filming the crowd and knew exactly how the people of his town were going to look to the rest of the state when this footage aired on the 6 o'clock news, like hyenas. Everyone stood out in bright relief, and everyone was a grotesque. He saw the blonde anchor from Channel 7 again knocked to her knees by the hypodermic sign, saw her pick herself up, saw a kind of unbelieving sneer twist her pretty face as she touched her head and looked at the drops of blood on her fingers. He saw a man with tattoos on his hands, a yellow kerchief on his head, and most of his features blanked out by what were probably old burn scars that surgeries hadn't been able to correct. A grease fire, Ralph thought. Maybe while he was drunk and trying to cook pork chops. He saw a man waving a cowboy hat as if this was the Cap City Rodeo. He saw Howie leading Marcy toward the steps, their heads bent as if they were moving into a stiff wind, and saw a woman lean forward to give her the finger. He saw a man with a canvas newspaper sack over his shoulder and a watch cap crammed down on his head in spite of the heat of the day. He saw the portly bailiff shoved from behind and only saved from a nasty tumble when a broad-shouldered black woman grabbed him by the belt. He saw a teenage boy with his girlfriend perched on his shoulders. The girl was shaking her fists and laughing, one of her bra straps hanging down to her elbow. The strap was bright yellow. He saw a boy with a cleft lip wearing a T-shirt with Frank Peterson's smiling face on it. "Remember the victim," the shirt said. He saw waving signs. He saw open, shouting mouths, all white teeth and red satin lining. He heard someone blowing a bicycle horn. "Hooga, hooga, hooga." He looked at Sablo, who was now standing with his arms outstretched to hold people back, and read the SP's detective's expression. "This is so fucked." Doolin and Gilstrap finally made it to the foot of the steps with Terry between them. Howie and Marcy joined them. Howie shouted something at the assistant district attorney, something else at the sheriff. Ralph couldn't tell what it was over the chanting, but it got them moving again. Marcy reached out to her husband. Doolin pushed her back. Now someone began shouting, "Die, Maitland, die!" And the crowd picked up that chant as Terry and his escort started up the steep flight of steps. Ralph's gaze was drawn back to the man with the canvas newspaper sack. "Read the Flint City Call," was printed on the side in fading red letters as if the bag had been left outside in the rain. The man who was wearing a knit watch cap on a summer morning when the temperature was already in the mid-80s. The man who was now reaching into his bag. Ralph suddenly remembered his interview with Mrs. Stanhope, the old lady who had witnessed Frank Peterson getting into the white van with Terry. "Are you sure it was Frank Peterson you saw?" he had asked. "Oh, yes," she'd said. "It was Frank. There are two Peterson boys. Both redheads." And wasn't that red hair Ralph saw sticking out from beneath the watch cap? "He used to deliver our newspaper," Mrs. Stanhope had said. Watch cap's hand came out of the bag, and it wasn't holding a newspaper. Ralph drew in all his breath even as he drew his Glock. "Gun! Gun!" The people around Ollie screamed and scattered. ADA Gilstrap had been holding one of Terry's arms, but when he saw the old-fashioned long-barreled Colt, he let go, dropped into a toad-like crouch, and backpedaled. The sheriff also let go of Terry, but to draw his own weapon, or attempt to. The safety strap was still fastened, and the gun stayed where it was. Ralph didn't have a clear shot. The blonde anchor from Channel 7, still dazed from the blow to her head, was standing almost directly in front of Ollie Peterson. Blood trickled down her left cheek.
"Down, lady, down!"
Sablo shouted. He was on one knee holding his own Glock in his right hand and bracing with his left. Terry took his wife by the forearms, the handcuff chain was just long enough, and pushed her away from him just as Ollie fired over the blonde anchor's shoulder. She shrieked and clapped a hand to her no doubt deafened ear. The bullet grooved the side of Terry's head, making his hair fly up, and sending a cascade of blood onto the shoulder of the suit Marcy had been at such pains to press.
"My brother wasn't enough. You had to kill my mother, too!"
Ollie shouted and fired again, this time striking the Camaro across the street. The young men who had been dancing on it jumped for safety, shouting. Sablo leaped up the steps, grabbed the blonde reporter, pulled her down, and landed on top of her.
"Ralph! Ralph, do it!" he shouted.
Now Ralph had a clear shot, but just as he fired, one of the fleeing spectators crashed into him. Instead of hitting Ollie, the bullet struck a shoulder-mounted TV camera, shattering it. The cameraman dropped it and staggered backward with his hands over his face. Blood streamed through his fingers.
"Bastard!"
Ollie screamed.
"Murderer!"
He fired a third time.
Terry grunted and stepped back onto the sidewalk. He held his cuffed hands up to his chin as if struck by a thought that needed serious pondering. Marcy scrambled to him and threw her arms around his waist. Doolin was still yanking at the strapped butt of his service automatic. Gilstrap was running down the street with the split tail of his awful plaid sport coat flapping behind him. Ralph took careful aim and fired again. This time no one jostled him, and the boy's forehead collapsed inward as if struck with a hammer. His eyes bulged from their sockets in an expression of cartoon surprise as the 9mm slug exploded his brains. His knees unhinged, he fell on top of his newsboy's bag, the revolver slipping from his fingers and clattering down 2 or 3 steps before coming to rest. "We can go up those steps now," Ralph thought, still in his shooter's stance. "No problem. All clear." Except Marcy's shout.
"Somebody help him! Oh, God, somebody please help my man!"
Told him that there was no longer any reason to climb them. Not today, perhaps not ever.
4. Ollie Peterson's first bullet had only grooved the side of Terry Maitland's head. A bloody injury, but superficial, something that would have left Terry with a scar and a story to tell. The third one, however, had punched through the coat of his suit on the left side of his chest, and the shirt below was turning purple as the blood from the wound spread. It would have hit the vest if he hadn't refused it, Ralph thought. Terry lay on the sidewalk. His eyes were open. His lips were moving. Howie tried to crouch next to him. Ralph swung an arm hard and shoved the lawyer away. Howie went over on his back. Marcy was clinging to her husband, babbling,
"It's not bad, Ter. You're okay. Stay with us."
Ralph put the heel of his hand against the soft springiness of her breast and pushed her away, too. Terry Maitland was still conscious, but there wasn't much time. A shadow fell over him, one of those goddamn cameramen from one of the goddamn TV stations. Yoon Sablo grabbed him around the waist and spun him away. The cameraman's feet stuttered, then crossed, and he went down, holding his camera up to keep it from harm. "Terry," Ralph said. He could see drops of sweat from his forehead falling onto Terry's face where they mixed with the blood from the head wound. "Terry, you're going to die. Do you understand me? He got you, and he got you good. You are going to die."
"No," Marcy shrieked. "No, he can't. The girls need their daddy. He can't."
She was trying to get to him, and this time it was Alec Pelly, pale and grave, who held her back. Howie had gotten to his knees, but he did not attempt to interfere again either.
"Where? Get me." "Your chest, Terry. He got you in the heart, or just above it. You need to make a dying declaration, okay? You need to tell me you killed Frank Peterson. This is your chance to clear your conscience." Terry smiled, and a thin trickle of blood spilled from either side of his mouth. "But I didn't," he said. His voice was low, little more than a whisper, but perfectly audible. "I didn't. So tell me, Ralph, how are you going to clear yours?" His eyes closed, then struggled open again. For a moment or two, there was something in them. Then there wasn't. Ralph put his fingers in front of Terry's mouth. "Nothing." He turned to look at Marcy Maitland. It was hard because his head seemed to weigh 1,000 pounds. "I'm sorry," he said. "Your husband has passed on." Sheriff Doolin said dolefully,
"If he'd been wearing the vest."
He shook his head. The new minute widow looked unbelievingly at Doolin, but it was Ralph Anderson she sprang at, leaving Alec Pelly with nothing but a shredded piece of her blouse in his left hand.
"This is your fault. If you hadn't arrested him in public, these people never would have been here. You might as well have shot him yourself."
Ralph let her rake her fingers down the left side of his face before grabbing her wrists, letting her blood him, because maybe he had that coming, and maybe there was no maybe about it.
"Marcy," he said, "it was Frank Peterson's brother who did the shooting, and he would have been here no matter where we arrested Terry." Alec Pelly and Howie Gold helped Marcy to her feet, being careful not to step on the body of her husband as they did so. Howie said, "That might be true, Detective Anderson, but there wouldn't have been a fuck ton of other people around him. He would have stood out like a sore thumb." Alec only looked at Ralph with a species of stony contempt. Ralph turned to Yunel, but Yoon looked away and bent to help the sobbing blonde anchor from Channel 7 to her feet.
"Well, you got your dying statement, at least," Marcy said.
She held out her palms to Ralph. They were red with her husband's blood.
"Didn't you?"
When he made no reply, she turned away from him and saw Bill Samuels. He had come out of the courthouse at last, and he was standing between the bailiffs at the top of the steps.
"He said he didn't do it," she screamed at him. "He said he was innocent. We all heard it, you son of a bitch. As my husband lay dying, he said he was innocent."
Samuels didn't reply, only turned and went back inside. Sirens. The Camaro car alarm. The excited babble of people who were returning now that the shooting was over, wanting to see the body, wanting to photograph it and put it on their Facebook pages. Howie's coat, which the lawyer had draped over Terry's hands to conceal the cuffs from the press and the cameras, now lay in the street, streaked with dirt and splotched with blood. Ralph picked it up and used it to cover Terry's face, eliciting a terrible howl of grief from his wife. Then he went to the courthouse steps, sat down, and lowered his head between his knees. Footsteps and Cantaloupe, July 18th through July 20th. 1. Because Ralph hadn't told Jeannie about his darkest suspicion concerning the Flint County prosecutor, that he might have hoped for a crowd of righteously angry citizens at the courthouse, she let Bill Samuels in when he appeared at the door of the Anderson home on Wednesday evening, but she made it clear that she didn't have much use for him. "He's out back," she said, turning away and heading back into the living room where Alex Trebek was putting that evening's Jeopardy contestants through their paces. "You know the way." Samuels, tonight clad in jeans, sneakers, and a plain gray T-shirt, stood in the front hall for a moment, considering, then followed her. There were two easy chairs in front of the television, the bigger, more lived-in one empty. He picked up the remote from the table between the two and muted the sound. Jeannie continued looking at the television, where the contestants were currently munching their way through a category called Literary Villains. The answer on screen was, "She demanded Alice's head." "That's an easy one," Samuel said. "The Red Queen." "How is he, Jeannie?"
"How do you think he is?"
"I'm sorry about the way things turned out."
"Our son found out that his father's been suspended," she said, still looking at the TV. "It was on the internet. He's very upset by that, of course, but he's also upset because his favorite coach was gunned down in front of the courthouse. He wants to come home. I told him to give it a few days and see if he doesn't change his mind. I didn't want to tell him the truth, that his father isn't ready to see him yet."
"He hasn't been suspended. He's just on administrative leave, with pay. And it's mandatory after a shooting incident."
"You say tomato, I say tomato."
Now the answer on screen was, "This nurse was wretched."
"He says he may be off for as long as 6 months, and that's if he agrees to the mandatory psych evaluation."
"Why would he not?"
"He's thinking of pulling the pin."
Samuels raised his hand to the top of his head, but tonight the cowlick was behaving, at least so far, and he lowered it again.
"In that case, maybe we can go into business together. This town needs a good car wash."
Now she did look at him.
"What are you talking about?"
"I've decided not to run for re-election."
She favored him with a thin stiletto of a smile that her own mother might not have recognized.
"Going to quit before Johnny Q. Public can fire you?"
"If you want to put it that way,"
he said. I do, Jeannie said. Go on out back, Mr. Prosecutor, for now, and feel free to suggest a partnership, but you should be ready to duck.
2. Ralph was sitting in a lawn chair with a beer in his hand and a styrofoam cooler beside him. He glanced around when the kitchen screen door slammed, saw Samuels, and then returned his attention to a hackberry tree just beyond the back fence. Yonder's a nuthatch, he said, pointing. I haven't seen one of those in a dog's age. There was no second chair, so Samuels lowered himself to the bench of the long picnic table. He had sat here several times before, under happier circumstances. He looked at the tree. I don't see it. There he goes, Ralph said as a small bird took wing. I think that's a sparrow. Time to get your eyes checked. Ralph reached into the cooler and handed Samuels a shiner.
Jeannie says you're thinking about retiring. Ralph shrugged. If it's the psych eval you're worried about, you'll pass with flying colors. You did what you had to do.
It's not that. It's not even the cameraman. You know about him? When the bullet hit his camera, the first one I fired, the pieces went everywhere, including one into his eye. Samuels did know this, but kept quiet and sipped his beer, although he loathed Shiner.
He's probably going to lose it, Ralph said. The doctors at Dean McGee up in Okie City are trying to save it, but yeah, he's probably going to lose it. You think a cameraman with one eye can still work? Probably, maybe, or no way.
Ralph, someone slammed into you as you fired. And listen, if the guy hadn't had the camera up to his face, he'd probably be dead now. That's the upside.
Yeah, and fuck a bunch of upside. I called his wife to apologize. She said, we're going to sue the Flint City PD for $10 million, and once we win that one, we'll start on you. Then she hung up.
That will never fly. Peterson had a gun, and you were in performance of your duty.
As that camera jockey was in performance of his.
Not the same. He had a choice.
No, Bill. Ralph swung around in his chair. He had a job. And that was a nuthatch, goddammit.
Ralph, you need to listen to me now. Maitland killed Frank Peterson. Peterson's brother killed Maitland. Most people see that as frontier justice, and why not? This state was the frontier not that long ago.
Terry said he didn't do it. That was his dying declaration. Samuels got to his feet and began to pace.
What else was he going to say with his wife kneeling right there beside him and crying her eyes out? Was he going to say, oh yes, right, I buggered the kid and I bit him, not necessarily in that order, and then I ejaculated on him for good measure?
There's a wealth of evidence to support what Terry said at the end. Samuel stalked back to Ralph and stood looking down at him. It was his fucking DNA in the semen sample, and DNA trumps everything. Terry killed him. I don't know how he set up the rest, but he did.
Did you come here to convince me or yourself?
I don't need any convincing. I only came to tell you that we now know who originally stole that white Econoline van.
At this point, does it make any difference?
Ralph asked, but Samuels at last detected a gleam of interest in the man's eyes.
If you're asking if it casts any light on this mess, no. But it's fascinating. Do you want to hear or not?
Sure.
It was stolen by a 12-year-old boy.
12? Are you kidding me?
Nope. And he was on the road for months. Made it all the way to El Paso before a cop bagged him in a Walmart parking lot, sleeping in a stolen Buick. He stole 4 vehicles in all, but the van was the first. He drove it as far as Ohio before he ditched it and switched to another one. Left the ignition key in it, just the way we thought.
He said this with some pride, and Ralph supposed he had a right. It was nice that at least one of their theories going in had proved correct.
But we still don't know how it got down here, do we?
Ralph asked. Something was nagging him, though. Some small detail.
No, Samuel said. It's just a loose thread that isn't loose anymore. I thought you'd like to know.
And now I do. Samuels drank a swallow of beer, then set the can on the picnic table. I'm not running for re-election.
No?
No. Let that lazy asshole Richmond have the job and see how people like him when he refuses to prosecute 80% of the cases that land on his desk. I told your wife, and she didn't exactly overwhelm me with sympathy.
If you think I've been telling her this is all your fault, Bill, you're wrong. I haven't said a word against you. Why would I? Arresting him at that fucking ball game was my idea. And when I talk to the IA shoe flies on Friday, I'll make that clear.
I'd expect nothing less.
But as I may have already mentioned, you didn't exactly try to talk me out of it.
We believed him guilty. I still believe him guilty. Dying declaration or no dying declaration. We didn't check for an alibi because he knows everyone in the goddamn town and we were afraid of spooking him.
Also, we didn't see the point. And boy, were we wrong about that.
Yes, okay, your fucking point is fucking taken. We also believed he was extremely dangerous, especially to young boys, and on last Saturday night he was surrounded by them.
When we got to the courthouse, we should have taken him around back, Ralph said. I should have insisted on it. Samuel shook his head vehemently enough to cause the cowlick to come loose and spring to attention.
Don't take that on yourself. Transfer from county jail to the courthouse is the sheriff's purview, not the city's.
Doolin would have listened to me. Ralph dropped his empty can back into the cooler and looked directly at Samuels. And he would have listened to you. I think you know that.
Water over the dam, or under the bridge, or whatever the hell that saying is. We're done.
I guess the case might technically stay in the open file, but the technical term is OBI. Open but inactive. It will stay that way even if Marcy Maitland brings a civil suit against the department claiming her husband was killed as a result of negligence. And that's a suit she could win.
Is she talking about doing that?
I don't know. I haven't scraped up enough nerve to speak to her yet. Howie might give you an idea of what she's thinking.
Maybe I'll talk to him. Try to pour a little oil on troubled waters.
You're a fountain of wise sayings this evening, Counselor. Samuels picked up his can of beer, then put it back with a small grimace. He saw Jeannie Anderson at the kitchen window looking out at them, just standing there, her face unreadable.
My mother used to subscribe to fate.
Me too, Ralph said moodily. But after what happened to Terry, I'm not so sure. That Peterson kid came right out of nowhere. Nowhere. Samuels smiled a little. I'm not talking about predestination. Just a little digest-sized magazine full of stories about ghosts and crop circles and UFOs and God knows what else.
Mom used to read me some of them when I was a kid. There was one in particular that fascinated me. Footsteps in the Sand, it was called. It was about a newly married couple that went on their honeymoon in the Mojave Desert. Camping, you know. Well, one night, they pitched their little tent in a grove of cottonwoods, and when the young bride woke up the next morning, her husband was gone. She walked out of the grove to where the sand started and saw his tracks. She called to him, but there was no answer.
Ralph made a horror movie sound. Ooh.
She followed the tracks over the first dune, then over the second. The tracks kept getting fresher. She followed them over the third.
And the fourth. And the fifth, Ralph said in an awed voice. And she's still walking to this day.
Bill, I hate to cut your campfire story short, but I think I'm going to eat a piece of pie, take a shower, and go to bed.
No, listen to me. The third dune was as far as she got. His tracks went halfway down the far side, then stopped. Just stopped, with nothing but acres of sand all around. She never saw him again.
And you believe that?
No, I'm sure it's bullshit, but belief isn't the point. It's a metaphor.
Samuels tried to soothe the cowlick down. The cowlick refused. We followed Terry's tracks, because that's our job. Our duty, if you like that word better. We followed them until they stopped on Monday morning.
Is there a mystery? Yes.
Will there always be unanswered questions? Unless some new and amazing piece of information drops into our laps, there will be. Sometimes that happens. It's why people continue to wonder what happened to Jimmy Hoffa. It's why people keep trying to figure out what happened to the crew of the Mary Celeste. It's why people argue about whether or not Oswald acted alone when he shot JFK. Sometimes the tracks just stop, and we have to live with that.
One big difference, Ralph said. The woman in your story about the footsteps could believe her husband was still alive somewhere. She could go on believing that until she was an old woman instead of a young bride. But when Marcy got to the end of her husband's tracks, Terry was right there, dead on the sidewalk. She's burying him tomorrow, according to the obituary in today's paper. I imagine it'll just be her and her girls, along with 50 news vultures outside the fence, that is, yelling questions and snapping pictures. Samuel sighed. Enough. I'm going home. I told you about the kid. Merlin Cassidy's his name, by the way. And I can see you don't want to listen to anything else. No, wait. Sit back down a minute, Ralph said. You told me one. Now I'm going to tell you one. Not out of a psychic magazine, though. This is personal experience. Every word true. Samuels lowered himself back to the bench. When I was a kid, Ralph said, 10 or 11, around Frank Peterson's age, my mother sometimes used to bring home cantaloupes from the farmer's market, if they were in season. Back then, I loved cantaloupe. They've got this sweet, dense flavor watermelon can't get close to. So one day, she brought home 3 or 4 in a net bag, and I asked her if I could have a piece. Sure, she said, just remember to scrape the seeds into the sink. She didn't really have to tell me that, because I'd opened up my share of cantaloupes by then. You with me so far?
Uh-huh. I suppose you cut yourself, right?
No, but my mother thought I did, because I let out a screech they probably heard next door. She came on the run, and I just pointed at the cantaloupe, laying there on the counter, split in two. It was full of maggots and flies. I mean, those bugs were squirming all over each other. My mother got the Raid and sprayed the ones on the counter. Then she got a dish towel, wrapped the pieces in it, and threw them in the swill bucket out back. Since that day, I can't bear to look at a slice of cantaloupe, let alone eat one. That's my Terry Maitland metaphor, Bill. The cantaloupe looked fine. It wasn't spongy. The skin was whole. There was no way those bugs could have gotten inside, but somehow they did. Fuck your cantaloupe, Samuel said, and fuck your metaphor. I'm going home. Think before you quit the job, Ralph, okay? Your wife said I was getting out before Johnny Q Public fired me, and she's probably right, but you don't have to face the voters. Just 3 retired cops that are this city's excuse for internal affairs, and a shrink collecting some municipal shekels to supplement a private practice on life support. And there's something else. If you quit, people will be even more sure that we screwed this thing up. Rouse stared at him, then began laughing. He was hearty, a series of guffaws that came all the way up from the belly. But we did. Don't you know that yet, Bill? We did. Royally. We bought a cantaloupe because it looked like a good cantaloupe, but when we cut it open in front of the whole town, it was full of maggots. No way for them to get in. But there they were.
Samuels trudged toward the kitchen door. He opened the screen, then whirled around, his cowlick springing jauntily back and forth. He pointed at the hackberry tree.
That was a sparrow, goddammit.
3. Shortly after midnight, around the time the last remaining member of the Peterson family was learning how to make a hangman's noose courtesy of Wikipedia, Marcy Maitland awoke to the sound of screams from her elder daughter's bedroom. It was Grace at first, her mother always knows, but then Sarah joined her, creating a terrible 2-part harmony. It was the girl's first night out of the bedroom Marcy had shared with Terry,
but of course the kids were still bunking together, and she thought they might do that for some time to come, which was fine. What wasn't fine were those screams. Marcy didn't remember running down the hall to Sarah's bedroom. All she remembered was getting out of bed and then standing inside the open door of Sarah's room and beholding her daughters sitting bolt upright in bed and clutching each other in the light of the full July moon that came flooding through the window. "What?" Marcy asked, looking around for an intruder. At first she thought he, surely it was a he, was crouched in the corner. But that was only a pile of cast-off jumpers, T-shirts, and sneakers.
"It was her," Sarah cried. "It was G. She said there was a man. God, Mom, she scared me so bad."
Marcy sat on the bed and pried her younger daughter from Sarah's arms and took Grace in her own. She was still looking around. Was he in the closet? He might be. The accordion doors were closed. He could have done that when he heard her coming. Or under the bed. Every childhood fear flooded back while she waited for a hand to close around her ankle. In the other would be a knife.
"Grace, Gracie, who did you see? Where was he?"
Grace was crying too hard to answer, but she pointed at the window. Marcy went there, her knees threatening to come unhinged at every step.
Were the police still watching the house?
Howie said they would be making regular passes for a while, but that didn't mean they were there all the time. And besides, Sarah's bedroom window, all of their bedroom windows, looked out on either the backyard or the side yard, between their house and the Gundersons, and the Gundersons were away on vacation. The window was locked. The yard, every single blade of grass seeming to cast a shadow in the moonlight, was empty. She came back to the bed, sat, and stroked Grace's hair, which was clumped and sweaty.
"Sarah, did you see anything?"
Sarah considered. She was still holding Grace, who was sobbing against her big sister's shoulder.
"No. I might have thought I did. Just for a second, but that was because she was screaming. The man, the man!" There was no one there.
And to Gracie,
"No one, G. Really."
"You had a bad dream, honey," Marcy said, thinking, "probably the first of many."
"He was there,"
Gracie whispered.
"He must have been floating then," Sarah said, speaking with admirable reasonableness for someone who had been scared out of sleep only minutes before.
"Because we're on the second floor, you know." "I don't care. I saw him. His hair was short and black and standing up. His face was lumpy, like Play-Doh. He had straws for eyes."
"Nightmare," Sarah said matter-of-factly, as if this closed the subject.
"Come on, you two," Marcy said, striving for that same matter-of-fact tone. "You're with me for the rest of the night." They came without protest, and 5 minutes after she had them settled in, one on each side of her, 10-year-old Gracie had fallen asleep again.
"Mom," Sarah whispered.
"What, honey?"
"I'm scared of Daddy's funeral."
"So am I.
I don't want to go, and neither does Chi."
"That makes three of us, sweetheart. But we'll do it. We'll be brave. It's what your dad would have wanted."
"I miss him so much I can't think of anything else."
Marcy kissed the gently beating hollow of Sarah's temple.
"Go to sleep, honey."
Sarah eventually did. Marcy lay awake between her daughters, looking up at the ceiling and thinking of Grace turning to the window in a dream so real she thought she was awake.
"He had straws for eyes."
4. Shortly after 3 a.m., around the time Fred Peterson was trudging out into his backyard with a footstool from the living room in his left hand and his hang rope over his right shoulder, Jeanette Anderson awoke, needing to pee. The other side of the bed was empty. After doing her little bit of business, she went downstairs and found Ralph sitting in his Papa Bear easy chair, staring at the blank screen of the TV set. She observed him with a wifely eye and noted that he had dropped weight since the discovery of Frank Peterson's body. She put a gentle hand on his shoulder. He didn't look around.
Bill Samuels said something that's nagging at me.
What?
That's just it. I don't know. It's like having a word on the tip of your tongue.
Was it about the boy who stole the van?
Ralph had told her about his conversation with Samuels while the two of them were lying in bed prior to turning out the light. Passing it on, not because any of it was substantive, but because a 12-year-old boy making it all the way from mid-state New York to El Paso in a series of stolen vehicles was sort of amazing. Maybe not Fate magazine amazing, but still pretty wild.
He must really hate his stepdad, Jeannie had said before turning out the light.
I think it was something about the kid, Ralph said now. And there was a scrap of paper in that van. I meant to check back on that, and it kind of got lost in the shuffle. I don't think I mentioned it to you.
She smiled and ruffled his hair, which, like the body under the pajamas, seemed thinner than it had in the spring. You did, actually. You said it might be part of a takeout menu.
I'm pretty sure it's in evidence.
You told me that too, hon.
I might go down to the station tomorrow and take a peek. Maybe it will help me put a finger on whatever it was Bill said.
I think that's a good idea. Time to do something besides brood. You know, I went back and reread that Poe story. The narrator says that when he was at school, he kind of ruled the roost. But then this other boy arrived who had the same name.
Ralph took her hand and gave it an absent kiss. Believable enough so far. William Wilson's not as common a name as Joe Smith, maybe, but it's not exactly Zbigniew Brzezinski, either.
Yes, but then the narrator discovers that they have the same birth date, and they're going around in similar clothes. Worst of all, they look something alike. People get them mixed up. Sound familiar?
Yes.
Well, William Wilson number one keeps meeting William Wilson number two later in life, and these meetings always end badly for number one, who turns to a life of crime and blames number two. Are you following this?
Considering it's 3:15 in the morning, I think I'm doing a fine job.
Well, in the end, William Wilson, number one, stabs William Wilson, number two, with a sword. Only when he looks into a mirror, he sees he stabbed himself.
Because there never was any second William Wilson, I take it.
But there was. Lots of other people saw the second one. In the end, though, William Wilson, number one, had a hallucination and committed suicide because he couldn't stand the doubleness, I guess. She expected him to scoff, but he nodded instead.
Okay, that actually makes sense. Pretty damn good psychology, in fact, especially for, what, the middle of the 19th century?
Something like that, yes. I took a class in college called American Gothic, and we read a lot of Poe's stories, including that one. The professor said people had the mistaken idea that Poe wrote fantastic stories about the supernatural, when in fact he wrote realistic stories about abnormal psychology.
But before fingerprints and DNA, Ralph said, smiling. Let's go to bed. I think I can sleep now.
But she held him back. I'm going to ask you something now, husband of mine. Probably because it's late and it's just the two of us. There's no one to hear you if you laugh at me, but please don't, because that would make me sad.
I won't laugh.
You might.
I won't.
You told me Bill's story about the footprints that just stopped, and you told me your story about the maggots that somehow got into the cantaloupe, but both of you were speaking in metaphors. Just as the Poe story is a metaphor for the divided self, or so my college prof said. But if you strip the metaphors away, what do you have?
I don't know.
The inexplicable, she said. So my question to you is pretty simple. What if the only answer to the riddle of the two Terrys is supernatural? He didn't laugh. He had no urge to laugh. It was too late at night for laughter, or too early in the morning. Too something, anyway. I don't believe in the supernatural. Not ghosts, not angels, not the divinity of Jesus Christ. I go to church, sure, but only because it's a peaceful place where I can sometimes listen to myself. Also because it's the expected thing. I had an idea that's why you went too, or because of Derek.
I would like to believe in God, she said, because I don't want to believe we just end, even though it balances the equation. Since we came from blackness, it seems logical to assume that it's to blackness we return. But I believe in the stars and the infinity of the universe. That's the great out there. Down here, I believe there are more universes in every fistful of sand, because infinity is a two-way street. I believe there's another dozen thoughts in my head lined up behind each one I'm aware of. I believe in my consciousness and my unconscious, even though I don't know what those things are. And I believe in A. Conan Doyle, who had Sherlock Holmes say, "Once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth."
Wasn't he the guy who believed in fairies? Ralph asked. She sighed.
Come upstairs and let's get funky. Then maybe we'll both sleep.
Ralph went willingly enough, but even while they were making love, except at the moment of climax when all thought was obliterated, he found himself remembering Doyle's dictum. It was smart, logical, but could you amend it to, once you eliminate the natural, whatever remains must be supernatural? No, he could not believe in any explanation that transgressed the rules of the natural world, not just as a police detective, but as a man. A real person had killed Frank Peterson, not a spook from a comic book. So what remained, no matter how improbable? Only one thing. Frank Peterson's killer had been Terry Maitland, now deceased.
5. On that Wednesday night, the July moon had risen as bloated and orange as a gigantic tropical fruit. By early Thursday morning, as Fred Peterson stood in his backyard on the footstool where he had rested his feet during many a Sunday afternoon football game, it had shrunk to a cold silver coin riding high overhead. He slipped the noose around his neck and yanked it until the knot rested against the angle of his jaw, as the Wikipedia entry had specified, complete with helpful illustration. The other end was attached to the branch of a hackberry tree, like the one beyond Ralph Anderson's fence, although this one was a rather more elderly representative of Flint City's flora, having sprouted around the time an American bomber was dropping its payload on Hiroshima. Surely a supernatural event to the Japanese who witnessed it at a distance great enough to save them from being vaporized. The footstool rocked back and forth unsteadily beneath his feet. He listened to the crickets and felt the night breeze, cool and soothing after one hot day and before another he did not expect to see, on his sweaty cheeks. Part of his decision to draw a line under the Flint City Petersons and call the equation complete was a hope that Frank, Arlene, and Ollie had not gone far, at least not yet. It might still be possible to catch up. More of it was the unbearable prospect of attending a double funeral in the morning at the same mortuary, Donnelly brothers, that would bury the man responsible for their deaths in the afternoon. He couldn't do it. He looked around one final time, asking himself if he really wanted to do this. The answer was yes. And so he kicked the footstool away, expecting to hear the crack of his neck breaking deep in his head before the tunnel of light
opened before him. The tunnel, with his family standing at the far end, beckoning him to a second and better life, where harmless boys were not raped and murdered. There was no crack. He had missed or ignored the part in the Wikipedia entry about how a certain drop was necessary to break the neck of a man weighing 205 pounds. Instead of dying, he began to strangle. As his windpipe closed and his eyes bulged in their sockets, his previously drowsing survival instinct awakened in a clangor of alarm bells and a glare of interior security lights. In a space of 3 seconds, his body overrode his brain, and the desire to die became the brute will to live. Fred raised his hands, groped, and found the rope. He pulled with all his strength. The rope slackened, and he was able to draw a breath, necessarily shallow, because the noose was still tight, the knot digging into the side of his throat like a swollen gland. Holding on with one hand, he groped for the branch to which he had tied the rope. His fingers brushed its underside and loosed a few flakes of bark that fluttered down onto his hair. But that was all. He was not a fit man in his middle age, most of his exercise consisting of trips to the fridge for another beer during one of his beloved Dallas Cowboys football games. But even as a high school kid in phys ed, 5 pull-ups had been the best he could do. He could feel his one hand grip slipping and grabbed the rope with his other hand again, holding it slack long enough to pull in another half-breath, but unable to yank himself any higher. His feet swung back and forth 8 inches above the lawn. One of his slippers came off, then the other. He tried to call for help, but all he could manage was a rusty wheeze. And who would possibly be awake to hear him at this hour of the morning? Nosy old Mrs. Gibson next door? She would be asleep in her bed with a rosary in her hand, dreaming of Father Brixton. His hand slipped. The branch creaked. His breath stopped. He could feel the blood trapped in his head pulsing, getting ready to burst his brains. He heard a rasping sound and thought, it wasn't supposed to be like this. He flailed for the rope. A drowning man reaching for the surface of the lake into which he has fallen. Large black spores appeared in front of his eyes. They burst into extravagant black toadstools. But before they overwhelmed his sight, he saw a man standing on the patio in the moonlight, one hand resting possessively on the barbecue where Fred would never grill another steak. Or maybe it wasn't a man at all. The features were crude, as if punched into being by a blind sculptor. And the eyes were straws. 6. June Gibson happened to be the woman who had made the lasagna Arlene Peterson dumped over her head before suffering her heart attack, and she wasn't asleep. Nor was she thinking about Father Brixton. She was suffering herself, and plenty. It had been 3 years since her last attack of sciatica, and she had dared to hope it was gone for good. But here it was again, a nasty, uninvited visitor who just barged in and took up residence. Only a telltale stiffness behind her left knee after the post-funeral gathering at the Petersons next door. But she knew the signs and begged Dr. Richland for an oxycodone prescription, which he had reluctantly written. The pills only helped a little. The pain ran down her left side from the small of her back to her ankle, where it cinched her with a thorny manacle. One of the cruelest attributes of sciatica, hers anyway, was that lying down intensified the pain instead of easing it. So she sat here in her living room, dressed in her robe and pajamas, alternately watching an infomercial for sexy abs on TV, and playing solitaire on the iPhone her son had given her for Mother's Day. Her back was bad, and her eyes were failing, but she had muted the sound on the infomercial, and there was nothing wrong with her ears. She heard a gunshot next door clearly, and leaped to her feet,
with no thought for the bolt of pain that pistoned down the entire left side of her body.
"Dear God, Fred Peterson has just shot himself."
She grabbed her cane and hobbled, bent over and crone-like, to her back door. On the porch, and by the light of that heartless silver moon, she saw Peterson crumpled on his lawn. Not a gunshot, after all. There was a rope around his neck, and it snaked a short distance to the broken branch around which it had been tied. Dropping her cane, it would only slow her down, Mrs. Gibson side-saddled down her back porch steps and negotiated the 90 feet between the two backyards at a lurching jog, unaware of her own cries of pain as her sciatic nerve went nuclear, ripping her from her skinny buttocks to the ball of her left foot. She knelt beside Mr. Peterson, observing his swollen and empurpled face, the protruding tongue, and the rope half buried in the ample flesh of his neck. She wriggled her fingers under the rope and pulled with all her strength, unleashing another blast of agony. The cry this occasioned, she was aware of, a high, long, ululating scream. Lights went on across the street, but Mrs. Gibson didn't see them. The rope was finally loosening, thank God, and Jesus and Mary and all the saints. She waited for Mr. Peterson to gasp in air. He did not. During the first phase of her working life, Mrs. Gibson had been a teller at Flint City First National. When she retired from that position at the mandatory age of 62, she had taken the classes necessary to become a qualified home helper, a job she had done to supplement her retirement checks until the age of 74. One of those classes had necessarily dealt with resuscitation. She now knelt beside Mr. Peterson's considerable bulk, tilted his head up, pinched his nostrils shut, yanked his mouth open, and pressed her lips to his. She was on her 10th breath and feeling decidedly woozy when Mr. Jagger from across the street joined her and tapped her on one bony shoulder.
"Is he dead?"
"Not if I can help it," said Mrs. Gibson. She clutched the pocket of her housecoat and felt the rectangle of her cell phone. She took it out and tossed it blindly behind her. "Call 911, and if I pass out, you'll have to take over." But she didn't pass out. On her 15th breath, and just as she really was about to, Fred Peterson took a big, slobbery breath on his own. Then another. Mrs. Gibson waited for his eyes to open, and when they did not, she rolled up one lid. Beneath was nothing but the sclera, not white but red with burst blood vessels. Fred Peterson took a third breath, then stopped again. Mrs. Gibson began the best chest compressions she could manage, not sure they would help, but feeling they could not hurt. She was aware that the pain in her back and down her leg had lessened. Was it possible that sciatica could be shocked out of one's body? Of course not. The idea was ridiculous. It was adrenaline, and once the supply was exhausted, she would feel worse than ever. A siren floated over the early morning darkness, approaching. Mrs. Gibson returned to forcing her breath down Fred Peterson's throat, her most intimate contact with a man since her husband had died in 2004, stopping each time she felt on the verge of toppling into a gray faint. Mr. Jagger did not offer to take over, and she didn't ask him to. Until the ambulance came, this was between her and Peterson. Sometimes when she stopped, Mr. Peterson would take one of those great, slobbering breaths. Sometimes he would not. She was barely cognizant of the pulsing red ambulance lights when they began to zap the two adjacent yards, strobing across the jagged stub of branch on the hackberry tree where Mr. Peterson had tried to hang himself. One of the EMTs eased her to her feet, and she was able to stand on them almost without pain. It was amazing. No matter how temporary the miracle was, she'd accept it with thanks.
"We'll take over now, missus," the EMT said. "You did a hell of a job." "You surely did," Mr. Jagger said. "You saved him, June. You saved that poor bugger's life."
wiping warm spittle from her chin, a mixture of hers and Peterson's, Mrs. Gibson said, "Maybe so. And maybe it would have been better if I hadn't."
7. At 8 o'clock on Thursday morning, Ralph was cutting the grass in his backyard. With a day devoid of tasks stretching ahead of him, mowing was all he could think of to do with his time. Although not with his mind, which ran on its own endless gerbil wheel, the mutilated body of Frank Peterson, the witnesses, the taped footage, the DNA, the crowd at the courthouse, mostly that. It was the girl's dangling bra strap he kept fixing on for some reason, a bright yellow ribbon that jiggled up and down as she sat on her boyfriend's shoulders and pumped her fists. He barely heard the xylophone rattle of his cell phone. He turned off the mower and took the call, standing there with his sneakers and bare ankles dusted with grass. "Anderson. Troy Ramage here, boss." One of the two officers who had actually arrested Terry. That seemed a long time ago, in another life, as they said. "What's up, Troy?"
"I'm at the hospital with Betsy Riggins."
Ralph smiled, an expression so lately unused that it felt foreign on his face.
"She's having the baby." "No, not yet. The chief asked her to come down because you're on leave and Jack Hoskins is still fishing on Lake Okomo. Sent me along to keep her company."
"What's the deal?"
"EMTs brought in Fred Peterson a few hours ago. He tried to hang himself in his backyard, but the branch he tied his rope to broke. The lady next door, a Mrs. Gibson, gave him mouth to mouth and pulled him through. She came in to see how he was doing, and the chief wants a statement from her, which I guess is protocol, but this seems like a done deal to me. God knows the poor guy had plenty of reasons to pull the pin."
"What's his condition?"
"The docs say he's got minimal brain function. Chances of him ever coming back are like 1 in 100. Betsy said you'd want to know."
For a moment, Ralph thought the bowl of cereal he'd eaten for breakfast was going to come back up, and he right-faced away from his lawn boy to keep from spewing all over it.
"Boss, are you there?"
Ralph swallowed back a sour mash of milk and rice checks.
"I'm here."
"Where's Betsy now?"
"In Peterson's room with the Gibson woman. Detective Riggins sent me to call because I see you's in no cell zone. The docs offered them a room where they could talk, but Gibson said she wanted to answer Detective Riggins' questions with Peterson. Almost like she thinks he could hear her. Nice old lady, but her back's killing her. You can see it by the way she walks. So why's she even here? This ain't the good doctor, and there ain't going to be any miracle recovery."
Ralph could guess the reason. This Mrs. Gibson would have exchanged recipes with Arlene Peterson and watched Ollie and Frankie grow up. Maybe Fred Peterson had shoveled out her driveway after one of Flint City's infrequent snowstorms. She was there out of sorrow and respect, perhaps even out of guilt that she hadn't just let Peterson go instead of condemning him to an indefinite stay in a hospital room where machines would do his breathing for him. The full horror of the last 8 days broke over Ralph in a wave. The killer hadn't been contented with taking just the boy. He'd taken the whole Peterson family, a clean sweep, as they said. Not the killer. No need to be so anonymous. Terry. The killer was Terry. There's no one else on the radar.
"Thought you'd want to know," Ramage repeated. "And hey, look on the bright side. Maybe Betsy will go into labor while she's here. Save her husband from making a special trip."
"Tell her to go home," Ralph said.
"Roger that. And, Ralph, sorry about the way things went down at the courthouse. It was a shit show."
"That pretty well sums it up," Ralph said. "Thanks for calling." He went back to the lawn, walking slowly behind the rackety old lawn boy. He really ought to go down to Home Depot and buy a new one. It was a chore he no longer had an excuse to put off with all this time on his hands. and was just finishing the last bit when his phone started playing its xylophone boogie again. He thought it would be Betsy. It wasn't, although this call had also originated at Flint City General.
"Still don't have all the DNA back," said Dr. Edward Bogan. "But we've got results from the branch used to sodomize the boy. The blood, plus skin fragments the perp's hand left behind when he, you know, grasped the branch and..."
"I know," Ralph said. "Don't keep me in suspense."
"No suspense about this, Detective. The samples from the branch match the Maitland cheek swabs."
"All right, Dr. Bogan. Thank you for that. You need to pass it on to Chief Geller and Lieutenant Sablo at SP. I'm on administrative leave and probably will be for the rest of the summer."
"Ridiculous."
"Regulations. I don't know who Geller will assign to work with Yoon.
Jack Hoskins is on vacation and Betsy Riggins is about to pop out her first kid at any minute, but he'll find somebody. And when you think of it, with Maitland dead, there's no case to work. We're just filling in the blanks."
"The blanks are important," Bogan said. "Maitland's wife may decide to lodge a civil suit. This DNA evidence could get her lawyer to change her mind about that. Such a suit would be an obscenity, in my opinion. Her husband murdered that boy in the cruelest way imaginable, and if she didn't know about his proclivities, she wasn't paying attention. There are always warning signs with sexual sadists. Always. In my opinion, you should have gotten a medal instead of being put on leave."
"Thank you for saying that.
Only speaking my mind. There are more samples pending. Many. Would you like me to keep you informed as they come in?"
"I would. Chief Geller might bring Hoskins back early, but the man was a waste of space even when he was sober, which wasn't often these days." Ralph ended the call and sheared off the last stripe of lawn. Then he trundled the lawn boy into the garage. He was thinking of another Poe story as he wiped down the housing, a tale about a man being bricked up in a wine cellar. He hadn't read it, but he'd seen the movie. "For the love of God, Montresor," the man being bricked up had screamed, and the man doing the interment had agreed. "For the love of God." In this case, it was Terry Maitland who was being bricked up. Only the bricks were DNA, and he was already dead. There was conflicting evidence, yes, and that was troubling, but they now had DNA from Flint City and none from Cap City. There were the fingerprints on the book from the newsstand, true, but fingerprints could be planted. It wasn't as easy as the detective shows made it look, but it could be done. "What about the witnesses, Ralph? Three teachers who knew him for years." "Never mind them. Think about the DNA, solid evidence, the most solid there is." In the movie, Montresor had been undone by a black cat he had inadvertently entombed with his victim. Its yowling had alerted visitors to the wine cellar. The cat, Ralph supposed, was just another metaphor, the voice of the killer's own conscience. Only, sometimes a cigar was just a smoke and a cat was just a cat. There was no reason to keep remembering Terry's dying eyes or Terry's dying declaration. As Samuels had said, his wife had been kneeling there beside him when he went, holding his hand. Ralph sat on his workbench, feeling very tired for a man who'd done nothing more than mow a modest patch of backyard lawn. The images of those final minutes leading up to the shooting would not leave him. The car alarm. The unlovely sneer of the blonde anchor when she saw she had been bloodied. Probably just a small cut, but good for ratings. The burned man with the tattoos on his hands. The boy with the cleft lip. The sun picking out complicated constellations of mica embedded in the sidewalk. The girl's yellow bra strap, flipping up and down. That most of all. It seemed to want to lead somewhere else. But sometimes a bra strap was just a bra strap. "And a man can't be two places at the same time," he muttered.
"Ralph, are you talking to yourself?"
He started and looked up. It was Jeannie standing in the doorway. I must be, because there's no one else here.
I am, she said. Are you okay?
Not really, he said, and then told her about Fred Peterson. She sagged visibly.
My God, that finishes that family. Unless he recovers.
They're finished whether he recovers or not. Ralph got to his feet. I'll go down to the station a little later, take a look at that scrap of paper, menu, or whatever it is.
Shower first. You smell like oil and grass.
He made a smile and gave her a salute.
Yes, sir.
She stood on tiptoe and kissed his cheek.
Ralph, you'll get through this. You will. Trust me.
8. There were plenty of things Ralph didn't know about administrative leave, never having been on it before. One was whether or not he was even allowed in the cop shop. With that in mind, he waited until mid-afternoon to go there because the daily pulse of the station was slowest then. When he arrived, there was no one in the big main room except for Stephanie Gould, still in civvies, filling out reports on one of the old PCs the city council kept promising to replace, and Sandy McGill at the dispatch desk reading people. Chief Geller's office was empty.
Hey, detective, Stephanie said, looking up. What are you doing here? I heard you were on paid vacation.
Trying to stay occupied.
I could help you with that, she said and patted the stack of files beside her computer.
Maybe another time.
I'm sorry about the way things went down. We all are.
Thanks. He went to the dispatch desk and asked Sandy for the key to the evidence room. She gave it to him without hesitation, hardly looking up from her magazine. Hanging from a hook beside the evidence room door was a clipboard and a ballpoint. Ralph thought about skipping the sign-in, then went ahead and entered name, date, and time, 15:30 hours. No choice, really, when both Gould and McGill knew he was here and why he'd come. If anyone asked about what he'd wanted to look at, he would flat-out tell them. It was administrative leave he was on, after all, not a suspension. The room, not much bigger than a closet, was hot and stuffy. The overhead fluorescent bars flickered. Like the ancient PCs, they needed to be replaced. Flint City, aided by federal dollars, made sure the PD had all the weaponry it needed and more. So what if the infrastructure was falling apart? Had Frank Peterson's murder been committed back when Ralph first came on the force, there might have been 4 boxes of Maitland evidence, maybe even half a dozen. But the computer age had done wonders for compression, and today there were only 2, plus the toolbox that had been in the back of the van. That had contained the standard array of wrenches, hammers, and screwdrivers. Terry's prints had been on none of the tools, nor on the box itself. To Ralph, that suggested that the toolbox had been in the van when it was stolen, and Terry had never examined the contents after stealing the van for his own purposes. One of the evidence boxes was marked Maitland Home. The second box was labeled Van Subaru. This was the one Ralph wanted. He cut the tape. No reason not to, with Terry dead. After a brief hunt, he came up with a plastic evidence bag containing the scrap of paper he remembered. It was blue and roughly triangular. At the top, in bold black letters, was Tommy and Tup. Whatever came after Tup was gone. In the upper corner was a little drawing of a pie with steam rising from its crust. Although Ralph hadn't remembered that specifically, it must have been the reason he'd thought this scrap had been part of a takeout menu. What had Jeannie said when they were talking early this morning?
I believe there's another dozen thoughts lined up behind each one I'm aware of.
If it was true, Ralph would have given a fair amount of money to get hold of the one lurking behind that yellow bra strap. Because there was one, he was almost sure of it. Another thing he was almost sure of was how this scrap had happened to be lying on the van's floor. someone had put menus under the windshield wipers of all the vehicles in the area where the van had been parked. The driver, maybe the kid who'd stolen it in New York, maybe whoever had stolen it after the kid dumped it, had torn it off rather than just lifting the wiper, leaving that triangular corner. The driver hadn't noticed then, but once he was rolling, he would have. Maybe he'd reached around and pulled it free, dropping it on the floor instead of just letting it fly away. Possibly because he wasn't a litter bug by nature, just a thief. Possibly because there had been a cop car behind him and he hadn't wanted to do anything, not even a little thing, that might attract attention. It was even possible that he'd tried to throw it out the window and a vagary of wind had blown it right back into the cab. Ralph had invested